Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
And follow your star, brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you.
Michelle Otto with us. She's the National Director of Clinical Services for Senior Helpers. She had her BA in psychology and master's degree in social work, counseling psychology, and gerontology. She's worked in skilled nursing, acute rehab, geriatric care management, and non-medical home care, hospice, oncology, and senior medical health. We're going to talk about something called the stay-at-home score. Michelle, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. When we talk about the stay-at-home score, what are we talking about?
What we're talking about is it was developed by senior care expert Dr. John Bowling from Southern Oregon University. So this is a quiz that will really help adult children be able to determine whether their parent can still live independently in his or her home. So it's a series of 8 questions that covers certain areas such as, you know, well-being, safety, family support, social interactions, personal hygiene, mobility, and the like. And it gives them something that's a little bit more tangible so that they can understand, you know, is my parent still able to remain independent in the home, or is it time to seek outside help?
You know, basically, I think with some of the stats, the statistics that I'm seeing in your press release, one of them is that more than 10,000 people will officially hit senior status each year. Each day of the new year, 2012, that's 10,000 times 365. That's a lot of people.
That is correct. That's a lot of people. We're getting into that phase here.
Okay, and we look at that. We look at the majority of people are going to need that kind of help, but then we run into a particular problem. There are so many people out there, and I don't want to take us off focus, but there's so many people out there that if that senior can't really function on their own, can't really move through the test, almost what do you do with them if you can't afford to put them into senior housing or some kind of an assisted living?
Well, that's what Senior Helpers does. So we connect professional in-home, we're a professional in-home caregiving company. So we connect professional caregivers with those seniors who do want to remain independent in their home. So we provide peace of mind for the family. We provide peace of mind for our clients, and we do a variety of things all the way from, you know, basic companionship to personal care services such as assistance with showering and medical appointments,
sure,
taking them to medical appointments, that type of thing. So that's their option to remain at home and remain independent with some assistance.
I think this is what we have to look at, just to throw a couple of numbers out here. The U.S. population will add one new senior every 13 seconds this year, 13 seconds. About 10,000 boomers will turn 65 every day. This phenomenon will continue every second and every day for the next 18 years. The senior population, 65 and older, in 2030 is projected to be twice as large as 2000, growing from 35 million to 72 million, representing nearly 20% of the total U.S. population. My goodness, you know, when we look at these numbers and we project out, I wonder how many people realize that the volume of seniors we're dealing with.
I think that's why we're trying to get the word out there and providing education for people and why the stay-at-home score is important, because there are going to be so many seniors out there needing help. And I think sometimes the adult children or those helping the seniors, they really just don't know the questions to ask. They don't really know, you know, when is it safe and how do I broach the subject if I don't feel like it is safe. So I think that really with the stay-at-home score, we're trying to, you know, promote that education and allow adult children something, a tool of sorts, to be able to look at and say, oh, you know, maybe my gut feeling was right here. You know, I don't think mom or dad is safe at home, because you're right, these statistics are alarming, and I really don't think that the general public is aware. So education is really key as we move into this transitional time here. It's been happening, but it will be more so prominent as we move along.
Yeah, let's take it beyond the education. Obviously, we need to know, but more important than the education is to know that there is a force behind it to be able to be there when the problem actually happens. I'll say that the problem is here now as it expands and it gets worse. And we have developed a lot of senior citizens, and my goodness, the numbers are actually shocking when we take a look at it. But you said an interesting word. You said the S word. You said when to know that it's safe to say. There are kids that are frightened to death to talk to their parents about something like that. That's got to be a very sensitive issue to be able to come to the forefront with a parent.
It is a very sensitive issue, and so that's why companies like Senior Helpers are there to help support the process. I think, you know, you don't have to go at it alone. You know, we're here to support. But it's a daunting thing when you come to that point of realization, oh, gosh, it's time to talk to my dad about driving. Ugh, you know, saw the dent in the car when I went into the garage yesterday, and oh, you know, he's having a really hard time getting up the stairs, or, you know, oh, gosh, he just doesn't seem to, I think he's wearing the same clothes as when I came over 3 days ago. You know, and you start to see all those things, and then you start to kind of put the puzzle pieces together, but actually having that discussion is very difficult, and engaging then in that discussion with the healthcare provider, you know, that is working with the senior, you know, that it is time to bring in some outside help. And, of course, seniors don't want to be a burden. They are afraid if they tell somebody things are going on or somebody notices that their independence will be taken away. I think those is probably one of the number one fears is loss of independence. So that's why, you know, home care companies like Senior Helpers can help them stay independent, you know, with some assistance. And so, you know, I think it's a daunting task, and it's probably one of the hardest discussions an adult child will have with their parent.
Okay, now let me ask you this question: the eight questions to ask. Is it from the adult child to the parent, or is it from the adult child answering to you, the professional?
Well, what it is an eight question quiz. So they can go online, they can take it, and then what it does is it's a sliding scale from always to never. So once they complete this quiz, then it will come out and kind of give them a score as to a quantifiable score that will help them really understand, okay, this is really where my parent is at. Okay, you know, we're right on the cusp of needing help, or wow, this is a little worse than I thought it was. And oftentimes we find that to be the case. You know, people like to call us when the crisis has hit, you know, and so this will give them a quantifiable, like you said, more of a black and white thing to look at, something more tangible rather than just kind of picking up on these little things, not really sure what to do with them because, you know, unless you've been in this situation before, you really don't know what to look for and what to ask. So this will give them something a little bit more concrete to hold on to. So they'll take the quiz. They get a quantifiable score that will really tell them, can my parent remain independent right now, or is it time to seek the assistance of some outside help?
Okay, let's put this on the other side of the coin now. We're talking 35 million and 72 million seniors representing 20% of the total U.S. population. That's all well and good, but let's really break this down to where it is, Michelle. How are you going to get that many people with the senior help to be able to be out there to take care of the problem? So how does somebody become somebody in your organization to do this? Because if you're not prepared, you know, if you got 2,000-3,000 people doing it, that doesn't even scratch the surface.
Sure. And I think, you know, again, with the continual education through media and through community education, you know, we're always seeking qualified caregivers who've worked in a wide range of services in the non-medical and medical field of caregiving. And so they come to us properly screened and checked and whatnot for the skill set that we need to be able to have them, you know, take care of a senior at home. But yes, it is a continual education and really supporting people in this career choice. as I think that we do by reaching out and, getting out there in the community and letting people know, you know, what a fantastic and rewarding career choice this is. And they do come from different areas of healthcare and again, just caregiving in general. And so we help to coach them and encourage them to become caregivers.
Okay, we're starting to run out of time now. Let me ask you this. Is there a website we can find you at, get more information?
Absolutely. It's www.seniorhelpers.com, and we have over 300 franchise locations across 39 states and one in Canada. And so if you go to Senior Helpers, www.seniorhelpers.com, it can lead you to the Senior Helpers location in your area.
Wonderful. And by the way, I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight. I really didn't realize that the number that we're looking at, and you're only talking about 20-some-odd years away before this really hits, and if you even take it beyond that, it's got to extend. So thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it, and hope everybody listens to this message, because the one thing that we will have, if you stay around long enough, we're all going to be one of them.
Yes, very true.
Okay,
very true.
Thanks a lot.
I really appreciate you having me. Thank you very
much.
My
God. Good night.
Good night.
There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? When there are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Toll-free call in number 1-888-429-5471 if there's a question that you have for me or the guest. And as a matter of fact, Joanne Mazzotto is with us. She's a mom, she's a grandmother, and a successful restaurant owner. And she is the author of Why Whisper, the book that allowed her to pour out of all of her emotions and struggles while coping with life after suicide. Joanne, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, good evening, and thank you for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. I can't even imagine what it would be like to have to live through something like that. It must have been absolutely devastating, devastating for you.
Yes, it was. It was.
Were there any signs?
I'm sorry?
Go ahead. Okay, I was saying, were there any signs, were there any indications that this was going to happen?
At the end, yes. Danny's personality was not depressing. He was happy. He loved life. Danny was alive in every sense of the word. And a personal relationship started a downward spiral spiral, and he entered that dangerous field of depression, and treatment didn't work. I mean, they were applying science to his pain. Yeah. It just didn't work.
You know, what about I noticed that there was alcoholism involved there.
Yes, Danny drank. He self-medicated. I think he started that in his young adult life, and at that point he stopped. Coping mechanisms disappear when someone becomes addicted. That's my take on it. And, of course, when the problem in his life loomed up, he couldn't cope with it.
No, John, let me ask you this. When something like this happens to a family, I mean, there's no question of what the result and effect is and the trauma that it has for the family. But where do you go to get support? Where did you find that place that somebody understood? Or did you have to go through it alone?
Here's the rub. When someone dies from an illness, there's a lot of support. When someone dies from suicide, I learned there's very little support. It's a subject people are afraid of. It renders them helpless. They don't come to you. It's very lonely. And I've tried grief groups. I've bought books. I couldn't talk to my own family members about it because they were in my shoes. So sure. I started to journal, and that's how the book became a book. I late-night journaled for 8 years, and when my husband read them, he insisted that they be published because he saw that there was no support. And I knew that grief needed a voice, and it's an energy. It had to be channeled, sure. And it gives people a place to go so they don't feel insane. It validates suicide survivors. Madness.
Absolutely. And I think one of the power of journaling is taking something that's inside, internal, and then externalizing, putting it out in front of you. That way, that doesn't mean that you're not going to get eaten up inside, but at least if it's starting to come out and you can see it, it's outside of you, and it doesn't have as bad effect as if you didn't journal and you kept it all inside. Because in essence, if it's that bad, it could have happened to you too.
It almost did.
Yeah.
Exactly. I went to the psychiatrists and then the grief counselors, and I was on 9 different antidepressant medication. And I realized one day that I was describing the symptoms, the side effects of these medications, which got them to give me more. At one point, I was taking a cocktail of them, and I just decided one day that I thought taking them all would be a good idea. And then there was a complete turnaround. That's when I began to heal, when I took all the medications and threw them away.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you this, and then through the journaling in the book, what's that message that came through for you? When you got into it, you began to realize that moment for you when it went beyond just intelligence, where you realized there was something more to this, that there was a message that actually had to go out to other people.
Well, first of all, I wanted other people to know that whatever they were feeling or whatever, however horrible they felt, that they weren't unique. They weren't alone, that there was a side of people that was with them, number one. And number two, I found that when you're giving, when you're giving someone else help, you feel better. Yeah. And that got to be more and more and more realistic for me. And then I came to where I knew, and everyone knows, that when you suffer for something that you had no control of, it's fate. But when you suffer for something you can control, it's choice. So that choice word started to be in my mind. And every day I said, I can do this by doing this. And it's tough and it's hard. And you can't cave because you have other children, you have a beautiful family, and God knows life is very beautiful in spite of my son's decision. And I didn't want to, I had to be present for my family, so that was my motive for fighting onward, and I got out of it.
Now, by the way, the psychiatry today, obviously you said you went to grief counselors, you went to different places, and it didn't seem to really do the job. You found your own answers within yourself. Where is Western psychiatry missing it? What's that disconnect to the healing process?
The disconnect is the treatment for depression and the gap between outpatient and inpatient. That's where my son died. He died when he was released from a mental hospital for depression treatment, and he died with that card for an outpatient appointment in his pocket and a belly full of Zoloft. The gap has to be closed. That's a dangerous field. So psychiatry, Western psychiatry, is failing us because they let you go just because they ask those two questions. Are you a danger to yourself? No. Are you a danger to anyone else? No. Goodbye.
Yeah.
Here's an appointment card. And that's that hole right there. Actually, there's a foundation being set up right now in my state called the Josh Barber Foundation, because that young man, almost the same age as my son, did the same exact thing at the same exact time. In the gap, that's where they fall through the holes. And the foundation is to bridge that gap, raise money to bridge that gap so that there will be follow-up care in that gap. And it's very important. That's the Josh Barber Foundation, called WAMO, WAMO.com. And it's a good, good thing because they're trying to rush these people out, and they can't get into the emotions of it. They're medicating them.
Yeah.
And there's no magic pill for this, because depression is a symptom, in my opinion. It's not a cause of suicide.
Sure. Now, by the way, there's that crossroads that they all come to when they're standing at the crossroads, and the value for dying or the value for life, whichever is the senior, they're going to make that decision. But when they start to feel a little better, that's when it gets dangerous. That's when they really need the help, because that's when most of it happens. It's when you're depressed.
Right.
Yeah. So it's that point also where the support has to be there. They can't be alone, and they have to be moved through it.
Absolutely. And I think that there's a need for more cognitive therapy than chemical therapy, because, science will tell you that there are 40 million neurons in your brain that are directly or indirectly responding to serotonin deficiency, and all that rhetoric, that doesn't help the patient to understand why they're feeling that way. I believe that compassionate therapy is what's needed in this country, if we ever see it. I don't know, but I wish we would.
Well, let me hold you up, Joanne. Is it compassionate therapy? Or is it, and let's go beyond understanding, is it relatable therapy? You know, people who have really deep alcohol problems, they have to go all the way down to the bottom before they look for help. Then they go to places like AA. And who are they dealing with? They're dealing with people who are recovering, but they're people who have been there, done that, and have a true understanding of what they're going through. And you can't get that academically. So the therapy for people that are right at that precipice has got to be with somebody who's been there, who's been close to it, who's been like yourself, that, you know, had somebody in the family that did that. And it's that understanding, because depression comes from when somebody doesn't understand you, when you're not expressing yourself out there, when you've got to stuff all of these things and you think you're in the wrong place at the wrong time. And that's really what causes it, and you have to have people around you to be able to walk you through.
Absolutely. I'm so glad you said that, because AA is, to me, I sat in the halls of AA just to figure it out. I'm not an alcoholic. I don't mind alter. I sat in those halls for years and years to find out how they crossed that bridge from hell to heaven. That program is the most, and as far as I'm concerned, the only way to find yourself again once you've been lost in the mire of addiction. I love it. I love AA, and I love Al-Anon. those two places can do a whole lot more, and it costs you zero to go there.
Yeah, and the other side of that, too, if there was a young girl who was pregnant and another woman talked to that young girl who'd never had a baby, there could never be that bond, because the one who didn't have the baby will never know what it was like to go through that. It takes another woman who's had a baby to be able to relate to it. And it's the same thing with alcoholism, with drugs, whatever the case may be, and people with very strong emotional problems. It takes somebody who, quote-unquote, been there, done that.
Exactly. And, you know, there's a thing that the program uses, this slogan, terminal uniqueness. People think that alcoholics and addicts are downtown with brown paper bags sleeping in doorways. That's not true. Doctors, lawyers, people who work in the Pentagon, they go to meetings. Those meetings didn't work. 90 million people wouldn't be going to them. Every family, poor, rich, in between, once a child in high school gets caught up in that stuff, it doesn't matter their background. That is a monkey that is brutal and relentless, and it kills people, and it kills the codependents with it. Sometimes the codependents die before the addict dies. It takes so many people that it's phenomenal.
Absolutely. There's an inner strength that has to be developed, and you used the word unique before. It's getting moving through those facades, those masks that we wear, and getting right down to the core of who we are, and realizing it's okay to be who you are, and nobody else in the world except yourself can give you permission to have a decent life. And when you get down to the core, the guts of it, and you realize there's more out there than just what's in front of you, things begin to change. But it's too bad that most people have to go through all the garbage before they can get to that point, if they ever get there.
Right. Though I believe pain is a prelude to evolving. It hurts, but you grow from it. Danny's death took us to places we never dreamed we were capable of.
Oh,
we are so different now. Our family is closer. We never leave each other without saying, I love you. We never take anything for granted anymore. And if Danny's sacrifice had to be a gift, that would be it. And to put closure on a child's death is impossible. Yeah. But you can adjust. You don't put closure. You don't ever resolve it. You just adjust. I mean, human beings adjust to everything, even jail, even being a prisoner of war. We find survival tools inside of us that we didn't know we had until we had to use them. But it takes time.
Joanna, here at Loud and Clear, we're just about out of time. Do you have a website? We can find the book, find you.
Yes. It's www.ywhisper.net.
Joanna, hey, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Look at the gift that you're also giving your son to touch those people. 100 years from now, you may touch a life that caused them to live, to have children, and on from there. So what a heck of a legacy, huh?
Thank you. Yeah, it's a good legacy.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night. You may
even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you know, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy, comes one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so good, you're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging, you're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, some of these days.
Welcome back. Rosanna Patia with us, MA, PhD, Dr. Patia, as a historian, an ethicist, and a senior global project manager who specializes in analyzing corporate structures and delivering practical solutions to organizational problems. She's the co-founder of the One Voice Institute of Elemental Ethics and Education, which is dedicated to positive changes in education. She's been published in the Journal of Higher Education, and her book is How Deconstructing the American School System Will Reconstruct the American Dream. Rosanna, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for inviting me on.
Oh, thank you. Did I pronounce your last name correctly?
It's actually Patella.
Patella.
It's Italian, not Spanish.
I looked at this and I said, okay, where am I going to go with that? By the way, the school system in and of itself, when we take a look at it today, I don't even recognize it. It was 300 years ago when I was in the school system, but it's not even recognizable. All of the basic concepts of what was taught early on, the reading, writing, arithmetic, quote unquote, preparing kids that if they were not going on to ongoing in it, higher education, continuous education, that they would go out and get a job and be ready to go to work. I don't see any of that anymore today.
That's right, because all the things that you're talking about are not the great focus of the standardized tests that are ruling our schools right now. So all that well-rounded stuff that all of us learned, you know, geography and social studies and all of those things, those aren't the important things for the test scores, and that has become the prime driving force in American education.
No, and it's called What is History Anymore? I would, you know, that can be three or four shows. You know, what American history? Yeah, that's exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
No,
that's what actually brought me to write the book, was because I encounter educators throughout the year, every year, and I was surprised at how many of even PhDs and, you know, high level professors actually knew very little about American history, and particularly the education system's history. So I thought, well, of course, that must be a contributing factor to where we are right now. You know that saying about those who can't remember the past are condemned to repeat it? Well, if you don't know how the school system got to where it is now, how can you learn from the history, right?
Yeah, it's an interesting system, because I think the emphasis of, quote-unquote, what's important has shifted. You know, in some of the schools, young women that can go out and they can have abortions and they don't have to tell their mom and dad, and the school, the school health authorities, who's ever there, can say that it's okay, condoms and so on and so forth. I don't recall anything like that when I went to school. The mindset was completely different. The kids were kids. They weren't kids trying to be adults.
Exactly. And that's such an important point. Children are not tiny adults. They don't learn like adults. Their behaviors are different because they're not adults. That's a very important point. But our schools are not developed by behaviorists or psychologists or pediatricians. We keep applying business methodology and military methodology, which really doesn't apply to children.
No.
That's why you're getting those kinds of vibes in schools.
And the other thing that's going on right now is everything, you know, with the political correctness, and everything is too sensitive and quote unquote. I happen to be Jewish, and I was raised with Christmas. I was raised with Christmas trees. I was raised with exchanging presents. Everybody that I knew, my friends were Catholic, and we did all of those things, and we sang the carols, and we did all of that. Now when they want to take all of these things that were tradition out of schools, I really object to that, because it's taking away the culture that I was brought up with.
Exactly. And think about it. When you were singing Christmas carols that didn't apply to you, so what? So you were learning about your friends in your community. So you were creating a larger, better bond with other people that you lived with. That is something that we've lost. You know, children go to play dates. They don't play with kids on the block out on the street. So those bonds are gone, and then when we become so politically correct that we protect our children from other cultures, we're kind of losing that whole beautiful, you know, synergy between people.
Absolutely, because I really, when it came down to it, it wasn't even learning about other cultures. I was part of that culture. We were all, quote-unquote, in the same culture, and the culture, Rosanna, was the American culture. That's where the key
exactly.
was.
Exactly.
Christmas is American.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, and now, we're losing it.
I'm almost afraid that we've lost it. But and by the way, the dropout rate is tremendous. 55% in Detroit, 20-30% across the board over the entire nation. The value for staying in school is not there. And if it's not there, look what happens to a lot of these kids that drop out. They get in trouble.
Absolutely. The lowest rate that we had in our country was actually in the 60s. It's always been worse since the 60s. And the truth of the matter is that because of this high, aggressive focus on testing, the children that are at risk for dropping out are nudged out and marginalized much more quickly now because their teachers are really worried about the test scores because they're held accountable for them and they're measured by them. So why would you want to keep an at-risk kid in your class that's going to look bad for you, and you don't think they're going to make it anyway. And make it, by the way, is defined by getting a high test score. Not learning
sure.
anything, not being able to do anything.
Now, let me take you back to the 50s. Not that I would remember, okay? But let me take you back to the 50s.
I would.
Okay, all right. You got, if you were a guy, you got out of line, you either were sent to the vice principal's office or the coach, you know, out in PE, and or if you were playing sports, and you got a hold of a telephone book. You put the telephone book between your head and the wall, and you bent over, and you got a swat. And if you jumped up, you got another one. That didn't. There was no blood. You weren't beaten. You weren't harassed. It just lets you know that this is not what you want, and you don't do it again. There's no consequence in the schools now.
No, and the problem is that I think the organizations themselves, the schools themselves, are trying so hard to meet everyone's expectations that they're not meeting anyone's expectations. I'm all for safety in the schools. I think that's
sure.
what we need to do. But discipline is very different than violence. And that's the problem. Not being able to direct a kid, not giving them guidance, it just leaves them, you know, loose and lost. And that's why a lot of them end up leaving. There's no reason to stay. What are they getting out of it? They're not learning anything, right?
Sure.
They're not getting any help. They don't have a mentor. So just leave. Join a gang where you can actually, you know, kind of have a relationship with people. Or go to hopefully get a job, even if it's a low-end job, do something. But those kids really need a better bond with the community and a better bond with people who know more than he does or she does.
Acceptance and identity is really what we're dealing with here. And when you come back to the schools, what we got taught was responsibility, accountability, and it took it when we were out of schools, went on to whatever occupations we got into, jobs we got into, which means what the employer says is what you do. You get paid by somebody, they say do this job, that's the job you do, because if you don't, you get fired and there's consequence. That's where the base of all of it starts in school.
I think it might even start earlier and be reinforced by school. There is a sense of honor that is
yeah.
lost. You know, we have a system that teaches children that it's good to be greedy. It's good to be number one. It's good to always be in the spotlight, right? Teamwork isn't so important. Learning something's not so important unless you're on stage. Do you know what I mean? All those kinds of things are really the important stuff. So we need to stop, you know, lauding celebrity and really laud the things that matter. The people that, you know, can do heart surgery should be more important, I think, than the celebrity on a Hollywood stage.
Yeah, and the other thing, too, is they're a little too sensitive with the, you know, I think 20% of PE across the board has been stopped. There's a lot of the games, you don't play dodgeball, you don't do this, you don't do that anymore, because somebody can get hurt, quote unquote. Somebody's always going to get hurt, no matter where you are. You know, it's getting to a point where I'm really believing that they're going to turn the rules of football around and everybody's going to be running the same way, you know, because everybody is now a winner and they're going to get a tag, and that's the way it goes. It doesn't work that way. Well, maybe it
doesn't. Well, and don't forget, we have a huge obese We have a huge obesity problem among American children. So if we're turning PE off and more kids are spending more time in front of televisions and playing with computers and so on, not to say technology is not good, because it is good, but not instead of physical exercise. Children learn by playing. In schools, we're spending more time teaching by rote so the test scores can go up, because that's what makes us happy, but it's not really great for the children.
Okay,
so
Rosanna,
you're right about that.
We're going to make you the queen of America now. We're going to give you the magic wand. You can do anything you want. Create the schools. What would you do? Go ahead.
Actually, I have designed a school model that learns from history. Basically, the premise is that there's nothing you can do in a standard American classroom that's going to close the gap between rich and poor children. But there's plenty you can do before school, after school, during school. The school needs to be at the center of a community. It can't be run by government officials and politicians that are unequipped, who know nothing about teaching. So you create a school where children are not considered standard. So therefore, standardized tests wouldn't make any difference, right? You wouldn't test against a standard if you realize kids are not standardized. But what you do is you incorporate learning with things that children enjoy and also apply them to practical life. There is a whole bank of research that's been done by very good educators that have created curriculum that ties, for instance, math, history, geometry, physics to real life projects that matter, that produce something, that do something, so that the child can see the practical application of their knowledge, not just answering bubble questions on a piece of paper. So that's a big step right there. The challenge with it is that you need to incorporate the school as a community center, which means that the community would have to run the school, not the state and federal government, which means you would have to probably give up their funds. So it would have to be self-funded. And I know that sounds crazy, but it really isn't. There are actually community schools all over the country that slowly but surely are raising their own funds. Even the children are involved with the fundraising because they own the school. They feel like they own it, and the communities around them own it too. And so they decide if there is a Japanese group, a community in their area, and then there's people that have come from Eastern Europe and Italian and so on. They all make the school successful. So there's that blending, you know, that melting pot that we're supposed to have. It creates relationships. And it also, just like the colonial schools, if everybody in your town knows you and they're helping to fund your school, are you going to break a window? Probably not.
No,
because everyone
no.
will know, right? And you owe them something. So there's a sense of bonding and a relationship. That resolves probably 98% of the problems we have in school right there, because people know you, they care about you, and you care about them. Colonial schools also had something called an exhibition day. So what they did is they actually performed. They had their kids perform for the community, do math problems, write poetry, do painting, dance, write music, whatever they did, so that the community could see what they had invested in. So they got to know those kids year after year. They became part of their community family. So very few of them failed. Now, granted, colonial schools only were for white males, so that wasn't so good, right? So you'd have to expand it a little to include everyone.
Sure.
But the other thing that bars kids from that kind of education is it's usually expensive. So what you would have to do, and this is not new either, didn't create this either, you'd have to make it all-inclusive and available to everyone, whether they could pay or not. You'd have to allow for bartering of services, which many schools do, small private schools do, and so that you're basically fulfilling what public schools were intended to do, but without torturing the children and teachers with standardized testing and opening it out into a greater educational place than a standard public school. So that would be my dream school. And by the way, I don't think it's a dream. I really think that's something very practical that we're going to be building in the next few years.
Now, by the way, I would stand behind you with that. But before we finish up, I want to talk about One Voice, but I want to get into something first. You mentioned bartering.
Sure.
If you go all the way back to when we began in this country, what did you do? There wasn't money. You traded this for that, and everybody survived, and they lived. So, yes. The other thing was, I'll give you a date, but don't tell anybody. Our secret here, okay?
Okay.
June 18th, 1960, I graduated high school. June 21st, 1960, I was standing tall at Marine Corps Recruit Depot in San Diego. And one of the things I learned, which is extremely important, was this, that if, and I thank God I was never in combat. It was too early for Nam and too late for Korea. But the one thing I learned was this, that if you had to do that, if you got in combat, you wouldn't care of a gender, ethnicity, the color of the skin, didn't matter. That person at your back was going to cause you to stay alive. So there was an equality that didn't quit. Now, I'm going to bring it forward to today. The government today, it doesn't matter left, right, or indifferent, but the government today is creating this kind of division that is causing us to separate. That also has an effect on the success of the school.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, you hit on a very sensitive point. We do not want to create a caste system in our country. It exists, actually, but we don't want to reinforce a caste system in the schools, not only by color, but also by class.
Sure.
You know, the way schools work right now, the public schools are maintaining a service class of people that serve the wealthy. That is not democracy. So, you know, I'm probably the number one patriot in the world in its purest sense. I believe in those ideals. I think that a school needs to reinforce them, not to create divisions between people.
Absolutely. By the way, I'm on your side of the table 4,000% with that. And we need to stop looking at these divisions that we're having. There are people today who live a decent life. They make enough money to support themselves. Some of them don't. But at the same time, they have what's called a family. And it's, if we can recreate that family strength, a lot of these things would stop. The family accepts you. You have identity in the family. You don't get acceptance, you go someplace
exactly.
else. You get a gang, you got an identity, you go out and get yourself killed, but at least you got accepted somewhere. I'm not
but
saying that's
you
good.
See where there's children who are lost, the homeless children, the foster children. In a community school, they have a family. It may not be their DNA family, but they have people who care about them and who are watching over them, and that fills a tremendous gap for those children who are really at risk.
Rosanna, I remember, when was it? I was 8 years old, and my father died.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you. But I was 8 years old. My father died, and I went to school that day, and it was very quiet. I didn't let my mom know that I knew, because I heard her get the news on the telephone that morning. He was in the hospital. So I went to school. I was very quiet. They had it stuffed inside of me. Teacher saw something was wrong with me, and she took me back into the coat room. And she looked at me and she said, "What's wrong?" And I started to tell her, and I broke down in tears, and she hugged me. You can't do that today. You hear it? You can't do that. You can't touch
a kid. Yeah, I know.
Today.
I have a problem with that, though.
Yeah.
Just because there are predators in the world, that doesn't mean that every person who tries to comfort a child is a predator.
Yes.
We need to use our minds. We need to use our intellect.
No, absolutely, and I completely, totally agree to that. We're starting to run out of time. We can find you, and where do we find out about One Voice?
There is a website. It's www.elementalethics.com, because after all, ethics are elemental. or you can just Google me on the web. I'm in a million places, and you'll find the website.
Wonderful. Hey, thank you so much for being here tonight. Go out and get them. I think you're doing a heck of a job.
Thank you. I'm going to hold you to that.
You got it.
Take care.
Night.
Hugging you, miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're going to feel lonely. Want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me in Rome, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so free. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss
some my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, your way had your way. And if you
welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark, 1-888-429-5471. That's the toll-free number if you want to join in, ask a question of the guest or myself. Darren Gibby with us. He is the author of Why Has America Stopped Inventing? He's a patent attorney with decades of experience with the U.S. patent system. He's obtained patents on everything from the latest mountain bikes to life-saving cardiac equipment. And after all of his experience building the IP portfolios for countless Fortune 500 companies, he's come to the sad conclusion that regular Americans have given up on inventing. Darren, hi, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me on.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. That's really it. We've given up. Is it because we don't think we can get out there and be competitive? Nobody's going to look at it. Or maybe we are so saturated with everything, there's nothing more to invent.
Well, let me address that latter point. Because that's been a common misconception for decades. In fact, you probably recall the statement that was made in 1836 by the head of the patent office, who kind of jokingly said that, I think we should close the patent office because there's so many things that have been invented there couldn't possibly be anything else to invent. He said that in jest, but he was ridiculed
sure.
for it. But I think if you look at where we are today, I think we fooled ourselves into thinking that we're the most inventive generation ever. But that's really not the case. When you look 150 years ago, Americans used to invent twice what they do now. I mean, that's an amazing statistic, that we used to invent twice what we do now. And the question is, why? What's driving that?
Is that a mindset, though, when we really come down to it? Because when you look at these things, there's a tremendous amount of things that still can be invented, and you've got the wherewithal of doing anything that you want to do, you know, through the computers, the software, and so on and so forth. And so there should be some incentive there. But do you think it's a mindset? Do you think we have been, quote unquote, Darren, taught not to do it because it's not going to do any good anyway?
Well, to some extent, and here's the reason why. Suppose you came up with a great new idea, say some wireless microphone, and you wanted to get it protected because you know if you roll it out, it will just be copied. Well, if you came to my office and said, Darren, how can I protect this? I would say, well, you need to get a patent, but to do that, it's going to cost you probably $20,000 to $30,000. It will take probably 4 or 5 years for the patent office to grant the patent, and then even worse, if somebody has copied you and you need to bring a patent infringement suit to stop them, it will cost you $2 to $5 million to be able to bring that case to a jury. And so you can see no individual can handle that much money. Small businesses can't. Startup companies can't. Even some of the mid-sized companies can't afford that. And so when you're facing that kind of pressure, and it's really the only way that you can protect your idea, you know, why bother? How can you succeed?
Well, okay, but that's the question. Can you sidestep that? Is there a way to move through? And obviously there is.
Well, you know, there really isn't a lot of other options, because if you come up with an idea and you don't obtain a patent on it, it's fair game. Anybody can copy it and sell it. And so, you know, you come up with a successful product, some big company will see what you're doing. They'll have their team of lawyers look at it and say, hey, this guy hasn't got any patent protection. And they will just copy it and sell it. And they're in their rights to do so, and there's really not a lot you can do to stop them.
No, and there's no question about it. But Is there a way that if you can't come at it directly, is there a way that you can move around it? Is there some maneuverability that, let's say that I did have an idea and that it was a good idea and it could be very creative and it could make a great business? How do I go about doing that without it costing me millions of dollars before I could even take the first step and worrying about somebody suing me? And that's not even a joke. I wish it was.
No, it is a very serious issue. I see it every day. And your options are somewhat limited. I mean, there are some things you can do, like you can file what's called a provisional application with the patent office. It's really a placeholder that sits there for a year, and that will give you a year to try to go out and to try to drum up some investors. And if in that case, if you do that, you'll have enough money at the year's end to be able to keep your patent application alive. If you don't do that, you can try to go to market without a patent. You can try to build up a brand name and use a trademark to protect that, but that only protects your brand name. Somebody can still sell the same product, just selling it under a different name.
Okay, but now we have a tremendous amount of that, and then we're dealing also with intellectual property. I mean, the list goes on here. But if I wanted to be safe, is there any way to be safe out there in the marketplace without having to spend the kind of money we just talked about?
Not that I'm aware of. I've done this for 20 years, and I've had thousands of people in my office, and you know, this is what I do every day, and this is the problem that I came across, and that's why I wrote the book and said, you know, darn it, we need to do something about this. And historically, it hasn't always been that way. In the mid-19th century, when innovation was just booming, the cost to get a patent was maybe $30 to $40, and it would take about 2 to 3 months to get a patent. Now, I realize that those aren't the same dollars as today, but even if you compared it to what that dollar is worth today, it's still an order of magnitude different. Well, let me give you another example. The Goodyear rubber case. When Charles Goodyear needed to enforce his rubber patent against Horace Day, he found the best litigator at the time, who was Daniel Webster, who was also serving as Secretary of State. But Daniel Webster was desperate. He needed money. And he said, well, I'll try it during my Christmas break, and I'll charge you $10,000. Well, the press got a hold of that, and they just went crazy. $10,000, they thought that was crazy that he would charge that amount of money. It was the most that had ever been charged for trying any case. Well, he won the case. He got the $10,000, and he got a $5,000 kicker for winning. If you convert that to today's dollars, it might be $100,000, $150,000.
Sure.
And you can see what the problem is. Back then, people had an incentive to invent, and they could stop people from infringing. Today, it's just not there, and that's why people aren't inventing.
Now, by the way, do you think that we can change it? Now, you were talking in your press release, I thought one of the interesting things, that most people have no idea that this even exists, which is the doctrine of equivalence. That in and of itself might stop people.
Well, that's what was put into the Patent Act to help people stop infringers. And this is kind of the ironic part, is the reason why the system has gotten so expensive is well-meaning patent attorneys said, hey, we need to make this system more fair. We need to protect our inventors. So they kept adding these doctrines and doctrines like the doctrine of equivalence, which says that if somebody copies your design and you have a patent on it, but they tweak it a little bit to try to get around your patent, and they change it just a little bit. Well, if it's not exactly, but if it's an equivalent, then you can use the law to go after somebody who's doing something that's equivalent. But you can see the problem is that nobody really knows what an equivalent is. Nobody knows how far away that you can get. And so these companies with these large patent portfolios, if anybody comes close to their space, they'll just launch two or three of their patents and say, oh, well, you infringe under the doctrine of equivalence. And if you're a startup company, you can't come up with the $4 or $5 million to fend off that lawsuit, and so they can just stop you in your tracks.
You know, which is interesting when we think about it. Well, one of the things that made us who we are was somebody going into small business, a lot of the small businesses, and they got larger and so on and so forth. But when you're dealing with this, that if you want to stop the competition, you do exactly what you just said, put somebody else out of business because they can't, it's not that they can compete with you, they can't be in business because they are infringing on what you have in the first place. So I can imagine that the rules and the regs on this, you probably couldn't pick up in weight.
Yeah, and it's Right, and large companies do this as a matter of course, and they're within their rights. You can't blame the large companies, because what they'll do is they'll see somebody coming into their space, and they're entitled to enforce their patents, and if they think they have a valid claim under the doctrine of equivalence, they're entitled to do that. You couldn't do that. You used to have to show that somebody did exactly what was in the patent in order to go after them. Here we are, and, you know, the question is, can we change this? And that's more of a tricky question, whether or not we'd be able to do that or not. In December of last year, Congress passed what they call the America Invents Act, where it was an attempt to remedy some of these problems, but the issue with it was that it was lobbied for by six of the major corporations in the U.S., and they put in provisions that would protect their interests. And now it makes it even more expensive to try to get and enforce a patent. And so, you know, the large companies come off smelling like a rose, and the small inventor or the people who really made this country are, you know, left holding the bag.
Realistically, and we're talking today, if you listen to all the politics, it doesn't really matter what side of the aisle you're on. It's all jobs, 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 business, business, business. And in and of itself, we've actually done it's almost a dichotomy. We've stopped businesses from being in businesses because of a lot of the limitations of the patent. The patent in and of itself is a good thing, there's no question. But then they take it to that extreme where it kills somebody's innovative ideas to bring something else about.
And you're exactly right. And let me give you a good example of how it used to be and how the system really should work. And that's back in the 1850s when the mechanical reaper was invented. And the main company was McCormick, and he had his reaper business. And what he would do is he noticed that the real good inventions were coming from the farmers who during the season would see problems with his reaper, and they would go out and they would tweak it, make improvements, and they would file patent applications. And so what McCormick did is at the end of every season, he would send out what he called patent scouts to scour the country, find the best inventions, and then he would pay the farmers for their patents. He would buy their patents from them. And then he would work like mad during the winter to incorporate these features into his next design. And so he made the entire United States his R&D lab. Now imagine how that would be today if we could have, you know, all these great computer programmers, these really smart people who could invent on their own, and then the large companies, which are great at making things and marketing and selling them, could buy up these ideas and, you know, improve the products, and then everybody would win. But the way that it works now is if you come up with a good idea and you have to spend all this time and money to get a patent, it just kind of shuts it down from the beginning.
And so no question about it. And I really believe if there's anything that'll happen, it's not going to happen. Darren, it's not going to happen overnight. Obviously, you're an attorney. You would know much better than I. But the process that you would have to go through to even change this and modify the patent laws in any way, shape, or form, there would be conflict after conflict. And the legal conflict after conflict, and by the time you were done, you and I probably wouldn't even be alive anymore.
Well, I think you're exactly right, because to get the America Invents Act passed, it took 60 years to get that one through. It had actually been drafted more than 10 years ago, and it took that long to get it to the point where they could vote on it. And so to say, you know, hey, it's not working, we need to redo this again, who knows how long it will take, but I will tell you that academia is looking at this. There's a lot of very influential legal professors who focus on patents who've looked at this bill and said, this is a real problem. We didn't do it right. Congress, we need to go back and revisit this. Now, this Congress obviously won't. I mean, you look at their approval rating, it's what, less than 9%?
Sure.
They're clearly not going to do anything, but maybe after the next election, we get some people in there who will have some incentive to do something. Maybe we could start again. But it will take a grassroots campaign. It will take a lot of people being very upset and being very frustrated to saying, look, we need to change America. We need to learn how to innovate again, because innovation creates jobs, and that's what we need. Let's quit sending the jobs overseas where they are inventing. Let's keep them here, and let's get a patent system where we can protect our own inventors and let them fix the problem.
Absolutely. By the way, I just remember, we get older, it happens to us. I was thinking lawsuit after lawsuit is what I was trying to say. We're just about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at, find the book, and get more information?
Yes, it's at Darren Gibby, DarinGibby.com. You can go to there. The book is in any bookstores. I also have links on my website where you can look through Amazon and Barnes & Noble and pick it up there as well.
Wonderful. Hey, Darren, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Yes, thank you for your time.
Take care. Good night.
Okay, good night.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. Well, that's all. Well, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, from now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Dr. Michael Williams with us, a leading authority on the law of attraction. And he's developed a number of techniques that he applied to his own life and his own career. And by using these techniques, he was able to obtain, listen to this, 3 doctorate degrees, build 2 successful IT companies, and serve as a consultant for companies and government agencies such as Bell Labs, NASA, the Department of Defense. Now, his most recent book is The Law of Attraction and the Subconscious Mind. Michael, hi, welcome to the show.
Yeah, good evening.
Oh, hey, thank you so much for being here. You know, it is so important. There's so many people out there, especially a month ago, that made all of these New Year's resolutions. I'm going to do this. I'm going to get that. I'm going to make money. I'm going to lose weight. And it goes on and on. And a very small percentage of those resolutions actually come to fruition.
Well, and there are key reasons why that happens. And one of the key reasons is, if you're interested.
Absolutely. No, go ahead.
Oh, okay. I thought you were trying to ask a question.
There's a little bit of a delay here, so we might stumble on each other. Go ahead.
Oh, hi, Paul. Okay. One of the key reasons why they don't adhere and stick to their New Year's resolutions is, it's one of the key factors in my book, it's the subconscious mind. You know, the conscious mind only really manages about 10% of your thought process. The other 90% goes off in your subconscious mind, and you know, most people don't even realize they have a subconscious mind, let alone it's working in the background. But what they've done is they've made a New Year's resolution, and and that's a conscious thought. Now the subconscious mind knows that it throws up a barrier. It has a filter that when you're trying to, accomplish something, if it knows it's not real, it's not going to allow it to happen. Like within the law of attraction, and one of the reasons how this book wound up coming forth was, I did a lot of research in that area over several years.
Yeah.
And found out unfortunately, a lot of the books out there, they go from point A to point C, and they leave out the, one of the most key important factors, and that's the subconscious mind. Well,
but it's,
you know,
but Michael, it's the ability to reach that subconscious mind. Let me say this a little different way. That 10%, 90% you were talking about. You got that 10% conscious, which is your logic, your reason, your willpower. That's the decision-making part of your mind. There is a filtering system that's a, it's an analytical sense of evaluation, let's call it, before anything can get into that primitive area of mind, which is the subconscious mind. Your conscious mind is responsible for, oh, that your central nervous system, your you think and you do things. Your unconscious mind handles that autonomic nervous system, like your heart, your liver, your lungs, your digestive system. You don't have to think about it, but these things are functioning. But it's being able to tap that subconscious mind intentionally. I think that's what we're talking about here, right?
Well, the key thing here is the subconscious mind actually works at a higher level than what you just described. That's the primitive brain that you know does your autonomic functions.
Sure.
The subconscious mind is working at a much higher function, a much higher level. But the key thing is when, you know, a good way to explain it is that it goes to these New Year's resolutions is, you know, same with the law of attraction. You know, people walk around all day long saying, you know, I'm a millionaire, like these books tell them to do, and nothing ever happens. Well, your subconscious mind steps up and says, no, you're not a millionaire, you're a cashier at Walmart. And until you can convince your subconscious mind that it's real, it's not going to happen. But once you convince it is real, I mean, it'll work night and day, 365 days a year, to make you that millionaire or whatever you decide that you want to accomplish.
Michael, let me jump in with something. Just you know, it's also called protection. If I don't think I'm worth anything, I'm going to do everything I can unconsciously to prove that I'm right about myself. And it's touching.
Definitely.
Yeah, and it's tapping into that unconscious mind to turn it. There's got to be a bridge to be able to turn that around. That's really what we're dealing with, yeah.
Well, within my book, I provide techniques. The key thing is understanding how to get from point A to point C, you know, and that point B is what's ultimately important. You know, and what I call, you know, I'm not trying to put down other authors that have put law of attraction books out there, but I call it the wish list principle. You know, and wish lists are what they are, wishes. You know, and until you can get your subconscious mind involved in the process, you know, not much is going to happen. But if you constantly, you know, with the techniques I have in the book, you know, you apply that to whatever you desire in life, and if one of them is to have a higher self-esteem, you can choose one of those techniques and apply it because every single one of those techniques work. Some are more advanced.
Let's make it practical. Michael, let's make it practical. Let's say somebody read the book, okay, and they were having a problem like you were talking about. Just one technique. How would they practically use that technique to accomplish their goal?
Well, you know, like I said, there's various techniques. Like, well, technique number one is Born to Be Rich. Is what I call the technique. You know, everybody values things differently. You know, what's important to you may not be important to me. And, you know, and you don't have to be born with a silver spoon in your mouth to be wealthy. But the key thing is, like in this technique, and all the techniques, I this is a key factor, too. You know, you have to determine what you want. You know, whatever that is, you know, and the law of attraction, you know, combined with the subconscious mind, you know, it doesn't work. You can't have a plethora of things. I mean, you can't say, well, I want a new car, I want a new job, I want a new wife, I want a new husband, I need a new boyfriend. If you put all that together, nothing's going to happen. You know, it works on, you know, it works on one thing at a time. But the key thing is, once you apply that technique, scientists discovered this years ago, when babies are born, they see the world upside down for 21 days.
Sure.
And magically, at the end of day 21, their worlds invert right side up. Well, through that process, they discovered it takes 21 days to create a habit. So every one of my techniques are required that you do it for a minimum of 21 days. That's why, you know, most drug and alcohol clinics have, when you check into those, they make these individuals stay for 21 days. Because if they know if they let them out before 21 days, they haven't created a habit to not drink or not do drugs, and they will probably go, I mean, as soon as they hit the street, they're probably going to be drinking and doing drugs again. So
repetition of action creates habit.
Well, it creates habit, but it's a function of the mind that for some reason at 21 days, it becomes a habit. If you stop before 21 days, and that's back to your initial question, you know, why people within 2 weeks fail with these New Year's resolutions. It's because they haven't gone 21 days. They go a week, they go two, I give up.
And by the way, something you said early on, let's expand on a little bit. We talk about definition. You know, and you have to say, you know, what does wealth mean? What does riches mean? If you've got an unconscious symbol that that's a bad thing, or your family wasn't rich, so you can't be rich, you've got to move through that. You have to have that bridge to be able to connect you.
I address that in the book, and a lot of it is due to our educational system, our Judeo-Christian system. You know, being wealthy is unfortunately, you know, for a lot of families, it's not good to be wealthy.
Look what they're doing today in the media.
Oh, it's horrible. I mean,
sure. By the way, where did you get your training for the mind?
Actually, I got it in my doctoral program. I do have a minor in psychology, but that's not really where I got the information from. You know, we did a lot of research into subliminal programming and marketing. And basically how to get information from the conscious mind to the subconscious mind to get, you know, for a marketing aspect, to get people to buy products.
Sure, yeah.
And through that process, you know, I learned a lot about how to get information from the conscious mind to the subconscious mind, and also a lot of many, many, many hours on my own doing additional research in that area. I mean, I've talked to psychologists and psychiatrists. Well, not any psychiatrists, but psychologists.
Yeah.
And I probably know as much about the subconscious mind as many as those individuals do.
That's very obvious. But when you're talking about the buying and you're talking about neurosciences, there's something called, I'm sure you're familiar with it, which is a somatic marker, something that ties that unconscious thought to a memory, which causes you to react. Maybe you get a shot of dopamine through the neuron. So it's all chemical. And realistically, when you begin to understand the mind, how it works, and be able to negotiate your way to it, it's actually a chemical change to the brain that you're doing, and it's intentional.
Oh, definitely. And through that process, what you're doing, and you know, through your visual cortex, along with verbal cues and verbal reinforcement by reading your affirmations and reinforcing them into your mind, you develop a sensory pattern that, you know, you do that for 21 days, that reinforces it, and it continually gets your subconscious mind. You bridge that barrier, and I'm not joking. I've received so many letters from people. I mean, people have become millionaires, from buying cars to getting the promotion they wanted to. You name it. I mean,
Michael, let's talk about affirmations for a moment, because most people, you know, they'll say something like, you know, I'm a wonderful, loving person, and the mind, and you said unconscious, doesn't accept it. There's a bioelectrical method to do that. It's thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. And you begin with an affirmation with the thesis, the theme. What is it you want to apply? And then you write down the emotional reactions, which is the antithesis, which stops you from being that. And then once you get to the bottom of that, you synthesize the two, and what you get is that bridge between the negative emotion and the affirmation that you started with, and it's something that the mind will accept. And I think that's one of the steps that people are missing when they do affirmations.
Oh, definitely. Most definitely. Well, and I mean, to take this and make it practical for the everyday individual that wants to apply these techniques, and the law of attraction and the subconscious mind, and basically attaining what they want, especially in these tough economic times.
Sure.
I mean, you know, you follow these processes and you apply these techniques, And again, like I said, I've received a lot of letters, people finding new careers and new jobs. A lot of people think they can't accomplish or move into new areas in, you know, in this tough economy. You know, you reinforce those techniques, you know, the synapses in your mind are going to be reinforced. And what you'll find, and what they call, you have circuit pathways in your brain between the brain cells, and they're called dendrites. And as you do, as you reinforce that through these techniques that I provide, your brain will actually grow additional dendrites, which will, you know, which are increased circuit pathways. And which reinforces the ability to, you know, the subconscious mind and the conscious mind to accomplish anything that you put your mind to. But there's, you know, but there's a process, and you've got to be able to bridge that gap. Because until you can convince your subconscious mind that it's real, and, you know, it's not going to function. And, you know, the subconscious mind, you know, it doesn't know right from wrong. I mean, it takes commands.
Yeah, your conscious mind is the goal to achieve, yeah.
Yeah, and your conscious mind is the right from wrong. Your subconscious mind says, you've convinced me, I'm going to do it.
And, no, absolutely. You know what one of the rock-solid proof of the law of attraction is? And people say, you know, prove it. You know, how do you know it's there? If you're running around in misery, if you're depressed, if you have all kinds of problems, if you don't have any money, guess what? You drew it. So all you're saying is get strategic with it and get intentional with it and use everything that caused you to be in that mess to reverse. And what you're saying is you've got the process to do it. But the law of attraction is, if you're miserable, you called it.
Well, the law of attraction, we are beings of energy, and we put off energy, and, you know, all our cells vibrate at a certain energy level, and fortunately, negative emotions and negative feelings vibrate at a much lower frequency, or you'd be inviting calamity into your life all the time, but, positive feelings, positive emotions, positive affirmations, you know, the techniques that I provide vibrate at a much higher frequency. And when you align those frequencies with what you desire in life, you will attract that into your life. And I provide examples in my book. I mean, it's fascinating. I mean, I use the law of attraction all the time. I was using it before I even knew what it was. I mean, I've got an example in my garage. I mean, I wanted the new Mercedes.
Nothing wrong with that.
Two door Roadster, hard top convertible. You know, it's $120,000 car. It's the Mercedes SL. Well, it's $120,000 car or more now. From the way I bought mine, but I applied the techniques, and I wound up getting that car for $21,200.
I bet the guy who sold it to you got fired.
No, it was a situation where a dealer filed bankruptcy, and I wound up going to the auction, the law of attraction brought it all together, and I got an incredible car for an incredible price.
I love every second of that. God. All right, we're just about out of time, Michael. Do you have a website we can find you at, find the book, and get more information?
Well, the website is obviously www.reallawofattraction, .net, not .com. You go to .com, you're going to go to some other place.
Yeah.
And also, it's www.real, R-E-A-L, law, L-A-W, of, O-F, attraction.net. You can purchase, a copy of my book, paperback or hardback, you know, through the website. I also provide links to, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. The book that's out now is the second edition, it's so new. It's only been out for a couple of months. It's not, and maybe on some of the stores bookshelves, but I don't think it's out there. The publisher's trying to get it out there now, but it's, you know, but if you go to the website, besides Amazon and Barnes and Noble, uh, it, I have a video that you can watch, a short video, and at the end it lists, you know, multiple bookstores around the country that the book will be either being sold at or will be sold at. So, you know, the book is doing fantastic, and the key thing is it's helping an awful lot of people. I've received, from my first edition of my book, I've received thousands of letters, and I never received a single negative letter.
No, that's great. Michael, that's great. We are out of time now, and if anybody missed the website, they can come to Dresser After Dark, www. It's going to be up there for a long time. Hey, Michael, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
All right, okay, everybody. Have a good night now.
Take care. Good night.
I've been in love
like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Once upon a time, a girl with moonlight in her eyes put her hand in mine and said she loved me so. But that was once upon a time, very long ago.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. For the last 35 years, Wellness Authority Julia Loggins has led a private practice in Santa Barbara, California that focuses on, listen to the word, detoxification. Certified health practitioner, Julia took her own real-life experience as a child suffering from life-threatening illness and created a career out of changing clients' lives through detoxification. Using a mix of nutrition, food choices, cleansing treatments and exercise, and lifestyle changes around sleep and stress, she created a 21-day program that results in a cleaner body and a more focused mind. Julia, hi. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how you doing?
Oh, I'm good, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when we talk about detoxification, most people have the wrong idea. And really, it's a cleansing process, but let's start from scratch. Where did you become aware of it, and how did it affect your life?
I became aware of it because as a child, I was diagnosed with something that was nearly unheard of in the 60s, environmental illness, environmental sensitivity. I was sensitive to the amount of pollution that was in my world, in my foods, and in just in my general environment. And I was lucky enough to have contact with a medical doctor, Dr. Robert Pottinger, who was one of the pioneers in the field of environmental illness and understood that detoxification was key to my getting well.
Okay, now, when you detox, And I know it's a cleansing. And when I say I know, I'm not a clinician, so I have no expertise in it. But it's a cleansing process. It's getting rid of all those toxins and things that are in your body causing all of the problems that we have. So what do we do with this? Because the majority of the foods we eat in the first place, there's got a lot of stuff in them. If you start reading the labels and if you eat anything out of a can, I think you're in trouble anyway. So what do we do? What's the first step?
Well, number one, I'd say the very first step is to know that we don't have to live in fear or be paranoid and think that we're going to have to live in a bubble to have optimum health. One of the things that I'm always work with in my clients is to know that we can exist in the world we live in with enthusiasm and comfort level, knowing that if there's some tools and techniques we have for detoxification, we're going to be safe and healthy and avoid so many of the illnesses that people are struggling with these days. And
oh, by the way,
one of
I
the
think,
most, go ahead.
Yeah, the name of the book in and of itself, it is a dare to detoxify. It is a dare for people. Mm-hmm. There are people frightened to death to change anything. You know, the old adage, rather unhappy than unsure. And it is a dare, but
absolutely,
once somebody takes that step, different story.
It's a different story. And people imagine that they're going to have to give up everything in their lives, how they do everything. But if there's a level of awareness that I can bring to people, that is the first step, to know that there's that if they can have some effect in changing the water they're drinking, the foods they're eating, that at least some of the foods they're eating are organic, even if it can't be everything. And if they can create some period of time, a couple of times a year, to do a gentle cleansing process, then they're going to be so much healthier and feel so much better.
Now, the cleansing process in and of itself, are we talking about going through a day or two without eating anything? What are we talking about when we talk cleanse?
It's a good question, because some people imagine that that is a strict juice fast or a water fast, and I've supervised people through things like that, and those can have a good effect, but the 21-day cleanse in my book is an elimination diet that allows for clean proteins, organic proteins, and suggests the reduction or elimination of sugars and white flour, things that are so hard on our bodies, hard on our digestion, hard on our nervous systems. Because what we're looking to detox is not only our foods and the in our environment, but also to take a look at our thoughts and how our lifestyle is affecting our stress. That is just as important to detox as a toxic food.
Now, by the way, when we're dealing with detoxification, are we also talking about colon cleansing? Because I, from what I understand, that colon, I mean, you've got miles and miles of pathways in your body, and you may have food stuck in there that's been there for 10, 12, 13 years.
Oh, absolutely. We have 6 feet of our colon. And Elvis Presley was, the coroner's report showed that when he died, he had 50 pounds of waste in his colon. That is, we know where that does not take us anywhere good. And it's absolutely avoidable. Colon cancer is the number one cancer threat to Americans, and so much of that is avoidable with colon cleansing and with healthy eating.
Now, by the way, and when you're talking healthy eating, you don't have to get absolutely nuts with this. If you just watch what it is, or better yet, watch the ingredients that are in the foods that you eat. Now, what you feeling about supplements?
First, I want to validate that you were so right. You don't have to get nuts with this. And that is a big theme of my book, because I feel that if people know that they can just do little changes in their lives, it's going to have a huge effect. Supplements, as long as a person understands that everyone is different, and if their supplements are assimilable and they are digesting them and absorbing them, then I've seen my clients do very well with supplements, and especially food enzymes, which
are they mimic the enzymes that our bodies already have in them, in our digestive tract, in our stomach, and they just add to them, they can be a very positive supplement. But I've also known people whose digestion, they're taking too many supplements. So I'd say one extreme, you know, it's one extreme or the other to avoid. One extreme is to not take any at all, and the other is to think, well, I can eat anything I want. I'm just going to swallow 50 pills, vitamin pills a day, and that'll do it.
Now, by the way, Julia, you said
that can be toxic.
Yeah, but you said an interesting word, and I think this is key. It's critical. You said absorption. How do we know what the body's absorbing? Do we have to take urine tests, blood tests? What do we do to find out if we have proper absorption for the particular supplement that we may be taking?
That's a great question. I'd say the number one key to knowing what you're absorbing is, what is your energy level? If you have a fantastic, strong energy level, that kind of energy that gently takes you throughout the day, all the way through the evening, and you're sleeping well, then you are likely absorbing your nutrition, your foods, and your supplements. But if your energy is lagging, if you kind of go up and then you're crashing, I would question absorption and check in with a health authority, a wellness authority, to have that check to see what might be triggering that.
Okay, I'm going to say something that isn't quite right because I'm not a clinician, but I learned something years ago. Let's say, for instance, if I had a deficiency in iron, so I started taking B12 and nothing was going on. Well, if I didn't, now this is a makeup something because I don't know what it is that would fix what I'm going to talk about. But let's say that I found out, but if I didn't take vitamin C along with that B12, the B12 is going into my skin and instead of being absorbed into my bloodstream. So there's those combinations of, and by the way, what I just said has nothing to do with reality except for the example here.
You're right about that, though. There's combinations of vitamins, things that negate each other and things that complement each other. That is the key to absorption. And you're very right about that.
Yeah, but I know about the B12 part. I got. I don't know what it was that would cause it to go to the blood instead of the skin. But the important thing is this. You're right. Just because we take a vitamin does not mean we're going to be, you know, healthy and feel good and whatever. And we are. We are also different with not so much our basic makeup, but the chemistry and the percentages of what and the dimensions of what that causes to be. And everybody is so different. And there's got to be some kind of test that somebody can take to say, all right, this would be the right thing to take. This you may need too much of. I got sick. Oh, I guess it was the beginning of last January, and I was doing fine. I'm running around, and all of a sudden, I dropped 20 pounds. Couldn't sleep at night. It was terrible. I mean, it was just awful. And it turned out that I had a calcium overload.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows where it came from? Yeah.
And how did you get that diagnosed?
Oh, I was a doctor.
Okay.
But
so
it was a medical
doctor, and he did. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but
he did blood tests. And,
yeah, blood test, yeah.
Well, and those are very viable. Although I'm an alternative practitioner, I work closely with medical doctors, and I believe in integrative medicine, and I believe in medical tests, and all of these things work hand in hand, one with the other. I don't believe that they need to exist separately. So, you know, the fact that you went and got a blood test is a good message to all our listeners to take action on whatever it is they're experiencing. Don't suffer. Reach out and get some answers.
No, and by the way, and I gained my 20-some-odd pounds back, and obviously it took me a while to get, and I became one of the most hated men in broadcast. No, I'm serious. I have a fan club that I hate Michael Ray fan club. And the reason for that is this. I can eat 3 meals, 2 desserts, and have a hot fudge sundae and lose a pound the next day.
Oh, wow. Yes, you,
yeah, say, oh,
you
she's
have a lot of very jealous listeners.
Anyway,
you have a lot of jealous listeners. Well, one of the things that I talk about in my book that our listeners can test for all by themselves is their acid-alkaline balance. And what we want. People may have heard of, you know, being too acid, being too alkaline. Being too acid is generally what we listen to these days and what we talk about and hear about. But it is absolutely possible to go to the drugstore or the health food store and get pH balancing test strips, and you can lick them, and we're looking to be between 6.5 and 7.5. And if we are balanced, then we are generally much, much healthier. And if we are on one side or the other too far, then that is something that we want to check in with a medical practitioner about. And those tests are free. I mean, they're not free, but they're easy to do at home. We don't need a doctor to read them. They can be done every day.
Okay, now here's the question. You got the book, but let's say, what if I wanted to go through the detox program, the whatever? Do you work with people? Do you do consulting where if you're where you are, and somebody else is in New York, can you work with somebody that way?
Sure, absolutely. Sure. I've worked with people on you know, helping them move through their program. There's also excellent practitioners all over the country who do this kind of work, and I have people come out to Santa Barbara, which is a pretty wonderful place to come and stay in a local hotel or inn and come visit me at my clinic, and we'll work together for a couple of weeks just to do a cleanse that's supervised and have some, there's massage and other things available that go along really well with this. But yes, I do also work on the phone with clients all over the country to help them through whatever their cleansing process is and whatever their goals are.
You know, it's really neat. We're starting to run out of time now, but you know, there used to be you'd work with somebody on the phone, but when they did the Skype videos, that's like sitting across the desk with someone, and you can work one-to-one with somebody, and you're right there with them, and there's that personal touch.
Oh, Skype is fantastic. You're right. It's changed consultation communication entirely.
Oh, absolutely. I was sitting here a week and a half ago, and I was talking to a man in Beirut, Lebanon, and I had the video on my laptop, and it was sitting on the other side of my desk, and it was almost like we were sitting in the same room at the same desk, and we were talking. Okay, Julia, we're out of time.
It's wonderful.
Website we can find you at.
Website, daretodetoxify.com.
Okay, well, do it slow.
Oh, daretodetoxify.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Julia, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I've appreciated it.
Thank you so much.
You're doing wonderful out there. I know a little bit about it, but from what I see, go get them. This is great.
Thank you so much. You have a wonderful, wonderful rest of your day.
You too. Good night.
Good night.
Off comes the makeup, off comes the clown's disguise, the curtains fallen, the music softly dies.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser.
But I hope you're smiling as you're filing out the door, as they say in this biz, that's all there is, there isn't any more. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling we're parting out as friends. Your cheer.
And that, my friends,